This is Taking Aim with
Rev Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, August 17th, 2004. Almost 3 weeks ago, Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge warned of possible Al-Qaeda attacks. The where was very specific. Financial institutions in New York City, Washington, D.C., and Newark, New Jersey. However, Tom Ridge was not as clear about when, although he and others in the Bush administration stated unequivocally that there would be an attack prior to the November elections. A White House official, however, acknowledged on Thursday, August 12th, that the documents and computer files that had been seized in supposed Al-Qaeda raids included surveillance reports of the financial buildings during 2000 and 2001, almost 4 years ago. However, the warnings did not include the documents did not include anything that suggested an attack was planned soon. The official said, although speaking on condition of anonymity, quote, "I have not seen any indication of an imminent operation. No evidence of terrorist attack." That's what was stated by the Associated Press writer Ted Bridas on August 12th. He was one of a dozen news organizations that had been part of the conference with this official. No imminent attack, and yet the police sealed off streets around the Citigroup building in New York and the New York Stock Exchange. Employees at the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank buildings in Washington were put through extra security checks, and Washington, D.C. became an armed camp. No evidence of terrorist attack. Today on Taking Aim, Peddlers of Crisis and the Committee on the Present Danger, the big lie from the Cold War to the War on Terror. Ralph.
As we indicated in our program last week, the invention of this supposed imminent attack on the financial district in New York and on the central buildings in Washington, D.C., derives from a sting operation of the Federal Bureau of Investigation in Albany and the Central Intelligence Agency with respect to Mohammed Naeem Nur Khan, who we documented is in fact a Central Intelligence agent himself. And indeed, with respect to Albany, the putative plans of the people at that mosque had to do with the planned assassination of the Pakistani ambassador to the United Nations as a plan of the Federal Bureau of Investigation itself, which underlines the real nature of the war on terror, the false flag category, which embraces 9/11 and continues to the very moment with the constant promise of new threats, new dangers, terrorizing the American people. But this has been the central motif for the military-industrial state, for the police state, for the ruling class, for its imperium, and for intimidating and cowering the American people for the past 60 years at least.
Let's look at some of the current intimidation of the American people under the guise of the war on terror. August 16th, Eric Lichbaugh reports in the New York Times, FBI goes knocking for political troublemakers. FBI officials, writes Lichbaugh, are urging agents to canvass their communities for information about planned disruptions aimed at the convention and other upcoming political events. And in fact, they did. They went in Denver, for instance, to members of the Denver anti-war group, such as Sarah Bardwell, 21 years old. She said that they were trying to intimidate us into not going to any protests and to let us know, hey, we're watching you. The unusual initiative, writes Lichbaugh, came from the Justice Department, and in an undisclosed legal opinion, it gave its blessing to controversial tactics that were used by the FBI when they urged local police departments to report so-called suspicious activity at political and anti-war demonstrations to counter-terrorism squads. And that is exactly what they did in Denver. In fact, the police kept files on some 3,000 people and 200 groups that were involved in protests. In Missouri, for instance, three young men were subpoenaed, and the legal director for the American Civil Liberties Union in St. Louis, which is representing them, said that these men had scrapped their plans to attend both the Boston and New York conventions after they were questioned about possible violence. Intimidation of young anti-war protesters. And it goes further. Arab Americans are targeted. Not only are the FBI going and interviewing people in their homes, but the Department of the Census received a request about the tabulations of the census that it had prepared in August 2002 and December 2003. The request came from the Customs and Border Protection Division of the Department of Homeland Security, and it was for detailed zip code level breakdowns of Arab American populations sorted by the country of origin. Ralph?
Well, we have to go to the demand now of Senator John Kerry that we establish what he called neighborhood watch committees in every part of the United States so that people can report any suspicious activity of their neighbors or anybody who visits their neighbors. A spy system, a totalitarian structure, which is the response of Kerry to the terror alerts, flanking Bush once again from the right, combining that with his defense of preemptive war, and articulating the fact that not only would he have supported the resolution to launch a war on Iraq had he known there were no weapons of mass destruction, but Kerry stated it's of no interest and of utter uselessness to raise any questions about the fabrication of weapons of mass destruction. That doesn't matter, he said, that's past now. We have an integration here, as we so often talk, taking aim, a full integration of policy, of perspective, and of plans, of what passes for two different parties, but are in fact one single political party representing the ruling class and its enforcement arm.
And Ralph, where this is best illustrated is in the Committee on the Present Danger. And on July 20th, Senator Joseph Lieberman, who had been Al Gore's running mate in the presidential campaign, the Democratic senator from Connecticut, and John Kyle, a Republican senator from Arizona, these two are honorary members of the Committee on the Present Danger. Now, this is the third incarnation of the Committee on the Present Danger, and today on Taking Aim, we're going to go through the history and what the Committee on the Present Danger has meant to foreign policy and national policy in the United States. The Present Danger is the title of an opinion piece published by the Washington Post, July 20th, 2004. And as Lieberman and write, their bipartisan consensus coming under growing public pressure, and it could fray in the months ahead. This is the bipartisan consensus of which Ralph spoke, by Republicans and Democrats, that there needs to be a very strong and effective war on terror. And as Kyle and Lieberman write, although the tide is turning in the war on terrorism, a political undertow in this country could wash out our recent gains. We must not let this happen. To make sure it doesn't, we are relaunching today the Committee on the Present Danger. In its third incarnation, write Lieberman and Kyle, we intend to focus on the Committee on the Present Danger, our generation faces. International terrorism from Islamic extremists and the outlaw states that either harbor or support them.
This is linked to an outright call for preemptive war. World War IV, as James Woolsey, the key figure in the Committee on the Present Danger, articulates, a prepared attack on Iran and on Syria, then North Korea, and inclusive of Saudi Arabia. They don't talk about this vaguely, but concretely and explicitly, and it goes to the issue that we have raised several times now in Taking Aim. of the announced plans of Sharon to launch a preemptive strike on Iran's nuclear electric power facilities, a position that's been supported by Kerry and is specifically embraced by his brother Cameron Kerry during his meetings in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem with Ariel Sharon. It's interesting to note, Maya, that in this piece by Lieberman and Kyle, The Present Danger, launching yet again the Committee on the Present Danger, which we're going to demonstrate has been a central integrating element since the late 40s in American politics, embracing both the Democratic and Republican parties. They conclude by invoking President John F. Kennedy in his inaugural address. In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted a role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. And they conclude, our freedom is in danger from Islamist terrorism, and this generation will not shrink from its responsibilities. Once again, the siren call, preemptive war, permanent war, militarization of the society, unquestioning obedience in response to trillions of dollars for war against all who are in any way in possession of the resources and the oil and the cheap labor that imperialism covets and requires to sustain its brutal and rapacious rule.
Ralph, following the Washington Post opinion piece and a press conference, the Committee on the Present Danger took out a full-page ad in the New York Times, July 21st. This generation's war must be won. We must begin, they write, with the proposition that victory requires common purpose, moral courage, patience, strategic clarity, and marshaling our national strength for the work that must be done. America faces its gravest threat in a generation. An organized global movement, assisted by rogue regimes, has adopted mass terror as a weapon to achieve political goals. And the prospect that this deadly collusion will involve weapons of mass murder is at hand. Now, the Committee on Present Danger is out for victory. This is what they write. Victory over terror inspired by radical Islamists fought in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere will be a long struggle. It will involve waging a war of ideas and educating the American people on the nature of the danger. And as Ralph mentioned, James Woolsey, the former CIA director, author of the notion of World War IV, the long war following the Cold War.
At least 45, 50 years of constant preemptive war.
Is the chairman of this current incarnation, the Committee on the Present Danger. And they have a website, www.fightingterror.org, where they give chapter and verse about their perceptions of the Islamic terrorists. It's a who's who of the neoconservatives listed on the in this New York Times ad, including Midge Dekter and Joshua Murachik, who happens to be her nephew, Ben Wattenberg. People remember Ben Wattenberg articulating the neoconservative position, Norman Podhoretz from Commentary Magazine, and William Van Cleve. And as I said before, it is a who's who. 41 neoconservative foreign policy hawks launching the third incarnation of the Committee on the Present Danger. Ralph?
One point again about their links to both the Democratic and Republican Party. Beyond the fact that they emerge from and emanate from the central leadership councils, the Democratic Leadership Council and the Republican Party itself, they are distinguished as well by their strong and organic ties to the Israeli state and to the Mossad, and specifically to the Likud, and specifically to the government of Ariel Sharon, and in particular in relation to Benjamin Netanyahu and the contrivance of the category of terror. when, as a 28-year-old Central Intelligence Agency operative in the United States with false identification under the name of John J. Sullivan and John J. Sullivan Jr. and Benjamin Netanyahu and Netanyahu, this CIA operative began to prepare conferences on terror in Tel Aviv and in Washington with George Bush and Senior and with George Shultz, linked to the Committee on the Present Danger, linked to this hawk-like control over foreign policy from within both parties. Look at the New York the New Yorker article "Dangers Present" by Nicholas Lehman, New Yorker issue of August 23rd, and I thank Professor and distinguished author Joan Mellon for calling this to our attention. Nicholas Lehman article makes this very clear. With a trumpet blare of martial rhetoric, the Committee on the Present Danger has reconstituted itself again. The original committee, founded in 1950, made up of cold warriors who stated that the country was insufficiently alert to the dangers of Soviet communism and, as such, required massive militarization, armament, and indeed preparation for preemptive war. Preemptive war. The second version, founded in 1976, had the same purpose, he writes. In retrospect, it was most important as a gathering of the foreign policy wing of the intellectual movement that was becoming known as neoconservatism, embracing both parties. It is armed as its chief political sponsors, Senators Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut and John Kyle of Arizona, put it, in the Washington Post, it is aimed at international terrorism from Islamic extremists and outlaw states or anyone that harbors them. Maya.
Ralph, we should also mention, we call these people neoconservatives like Max Kampelman, but these are people who have been at the highest levels of state. Dov Zakim, for instance, one of the signatories of the current incarnation of the Committee on the Present Danger, was the controller for the Department of Defense until he stepped down, and one of the authors of Rebuilding America's Defenses, the Project for the New American Century statement that was the guiding methodology of the Bush administration in its 2000 campaign, and also has been the seminal document for the reshaping of the Department of Defense and the priorities, including what we see today, the withdrawal of troops from Europe and their redeployment elsewhere in the world. I think we should go back now through the history of the Committee on the Present Danger. But do you have a comment first?
Well, I just wanted to make a remark, Maya. I'm glad you invoked of, tell me his name again.
Zakim.
Yes, Zakim. Rabbi Dov Zakim is a very important figure, not only because of his central role in the Pentagon, but because he is linked, as I mentioned before, to the Likud and to JINSA, the Jewish Institute of National Security Affairs, to Richard Perle and to Paul Wolfowitz, and in the category of terror that Netanyahu contrived. And in specific terms, this man was involved with the disappearance of trillions of dollars of Pentagon funds. When Robert J. Lieberman, for the General Accounting Office, documented that $7.6 trillion have no paper trail, that, as Dan Rather on CBS announced on September 10th, $2.3 trillion had disappeared from Pentagon books, Rabbi Dov Zakim is central to that process. Of course, it's not an individual issue here. It's a question of the structure of power. It's a question of the relationship of the Zionist state to imperial policy in the Arab East. The category of terror is the rationale for fragmenting each Arab country in its turn and for seizing its resources. The central document that defines policy through the Committee on the Present Danger in its second incarnation.
Ralph, the Committee on the Present Danger, as I said, includes people from the highest levels of state, and this goes back all the way to the administration of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In fact, one of the key figures, the person who wrote the manifesto for the first Committee on the Present Danger in 1950, was none other than Robert E. Sherwood, the renowned writer and the author of the screenplays Man on a Tightrope, the best years of our lives, Abe Lincoln in Illinois, and the Petrified Forest. As well, it included the chair was James Conant, the James B. Conant, who was the president of Harvard University.
Well, Maya, let me just mention, since you mentioned Robert Sherwood, he wrote what is in effect an official biography of the New Deal, or a history of the New Deal for Franklin Roosevelt. He is the quintessential liberal New Dealer, integral to, as many of the so-called liberals are, integral to this plan for the militarization of the society and for preemptive war and for the massive, massive development of a military forward arm for U.S. imperialism to destroy not just the Soviet Union, but any challenge, any class challenge to imperial control of the resources of the planet.
And the founders of the first Committee on the Present Danger were James B. Conant, as I said, the president of Harvard University, who provided the stage for the introduction of the Marshall Plan, actually, and had been a member of the interim committee that made the decision to use the atomic bomb against Japanese cities without providing any warning, and specifically to include cities that had never been bombed before, the test case. Vannevar Bush, the renowned electrical engineer and computer scientist. Many consider the work of Vannevar Bush to be what led to the development much later on of the Internet and the concept of the hyperlink. It was Vannevar Bush who had first proposed to Franklin Delano Roosevelt the setting up of a National Defense Research Committee. And he was the first chair before Conant later became the chair. And the importance of this committee is that it mobilized industry and the academia to work with the Pentagon to develop military research. In other words, the corporatist state bringing together government, military, business, leaders to coordinate the state. And it was also Vannevar Bush who led to the restructuring of the Department of Defense. The third person who was instrumental in setting up the Committee of for the Present Danger was Tracy Voorhees, who had been first a special assistant to the Secretary of War during the Roosevelt administration, and then he was Assistant Secretary of the Army and Undersecretary of the Army, and he became the Vice Chair of the Committee on the Present Danger. But most of all, in the beginning of the Committee on Present Danger, was Paul Nitze. And Paul Nitze is somebody who, like Max Kampelman later on, and James Schlesinger, served in all the administrations, Republican and Democratic Party alike. It was at the recommendation of Secretary of State Dean Acheson that President Truman in 1950 commissioned a report called NSC 68. That's how the shorthand for how it was later called. It was the report by the Secretaries of State and Defense on, quote, United States objectives and programs for national security, and it was released April 7th, 1950. It was a joint review of U.S. and foreign and military policy, and it became a blueprint for a fourfold increase in military spending, particularly on nuclear forces. Ralph?
One of the elements here that I think is essential to make clear to people is the relationship of the Committee on the Present Danger and those architects of an aggressive, massive military adventurism on the part of U.S. capital and U.S. imperialism, and their relationship to the rise of Nazism and fascism in Germany, not only in Germany but in other parts of the world. Finance capital from Avril Harriman's banking connections in the Prescott Bush and Bush family's banking connections to German capital, to the Dulles brothers, Alan and John Foster Dulles, to the central banking instruments of the United States, to those of German finance capital. These were the sources for the funding of the Nazi Party as the collapse of the economy in Germany gave rise to the prospect of revolution in Germany, and Hitler was backed. And I mention that in particular because it has a relationship to what we're discussing now that is very specific. In order to advance the military state and to introduce universal military training in 1946 and with the formation of the Committee on the Present Danger, the entire Nazi apparatus was integrated within the Central Intelligence Agency. Speidel and Heusinger, the Nazi general staff, were made heads of NATO. Von Galen, the head of Hitler's Eastern Intelligence Services, was integrated within the Central Intelligence Agency and put in charge of all U.S. intelligence for Eastern Europe. Indeed, Operation Paperclip integrated all of the Nazi figures, including those involved in extermination in the Central Intelligence Agency programs, and a key figure, Wernher von Braun, was linked to the attempts of the Committee on the Present Danger to generalize and to call for the massive militarization of American society. In the article coming up to date on August 23rd in the New Yorker, Nicholas Lehman makes the following observation. Central in the new committee was Peter Hannaford, who was the lobbyist in Washington for the Nazi Austrian Freedom Party in Austria. The circle is closed. Maya.
The circle is closed, but let's go back to the beginning of this circle, and that's with NSC 68, the blueprint for the vast escalation of the military-industrial state. And this, as I said, it was the document then which really bears much relationship to rebuilding America's defenses of the PNAC in 2000. The NSC 68 opened with this declaration, quote, "The Soviet Union, unlike previous aspirants to hegemony, is animated by a new fanatic faith, antithetical to our own, and seeks to impose its absolute authority over the rest of the world. Conflict has, therefore, become endemic. The growing intensity of the conflict, which has been imposed upon us, however, requires the changes of emphasis and the additions that are apparent." And what they meant by the change of emphasis was a transformation towards a militarized budget, and as I mentioned before, the Department of Defense budget rose 3 to 4 times from its 1950 level, and there was a stress on atomic capacity. Quote, it also stated, "Budgetary considerations will need to be subordinated to the stark fact that our very independence as a nation may be at stake," end quote. And NSC 68 gave a long list of programs that were necessary, quote, "to frustrate the Kremlin design." And it went on to say it would require a substantial increase in expenditures for military purposes. Doesn't this sound just like what we hear today from both John Kerry and President Bush? The same verbiage. The same verbiage as was given in 1950 to combine the military and industry for the militarized industrial state. Forget social programs.
Maya, this is a relationship between liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans. It has its class content, and that is presiding over the apparatus of a ruling class and its imperial state, with the necessity to thrust aside any pretense about outright preemptive war, outright imperial reach. Lehman writes again in the New Yorker, "When James B. Conant, the president of Harvard and the chair of the Committee on the Present Danger, sought out to alert the country as joltingly as possible to the Soviet threat, he sought to take anti-communism out of the exclusive control of people like Senator Joseph McCarthy. And he began his 2-year crusade for required military service for every 18-year-old American male with no exception. He planned for an enormous standing army of 4 million people, universal military training." And one of the points that is made here, interestingly, by Lehman is the following. "The reason John Kerry seems French to some people is that his father was the key figure for Conant in 1954 in preparing for the militarization of the United States." And the young Kerry, while his father was engaged in his committee on the present danger, was sent to a finishing school in Switzerland, where he was in contact, of course, with his father on a constant basis. It is Kerry who chose to fight, not Bush. It is Kerry who embodies the spirit of the original Committee on the Present Danger, writes Lehman. It is not just coincidence that he has a personal connection to its chairman, quote unquote, from
Ralph,
the New Yorker.
That's because Kerry's father worked under Conant when Conant was the U.S. High Commissioner in Germany and then became the ambassador to Germany.
And one of the points that Lehman makes is that the Committee on the Present Danger, then and now, constantly sought to assure the American people that this would be a cakewalk, that there would be no opposition, and that indeed the United States would profit.
Hi, I'm Saad Massi. Masa al khair, ana Saad Massi. Thank you for listening to WBAI.
Listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Peddlers of Crisis and the Committee on the Present Danger, the Big Lie from the Cold War to the War on Terror. Sorry to interrupt you, Ralph.
No, that's all right. Lehman makes the important point that, as he put it, then as now, the U.S. hawks present the sacrifices of war as minimal, no conscription, no taxation, very little price to be paid, and it makes the war and the preparation for war easier to sell. But he writes, the mood amongst the American people is angry and mistrustful, amongst military families in particular, who feel they are being ill-used. So the new Committee on the Present Danger states it will not allow the United States to retreat, and indeed it sounds the alarm for further war and preemptive war, aggressive actions that it advocates and it seeks to impose. But he says, if they imply that this will have a minimal price and they will win their argument, the bitterness of today's political atmosphere will soon seem like a distant elysium of national harmony, writes Nicholas Lehman. Indeed, he is right. As we are mobilizing for the Million Worker March on Washington on October 17th, the people of the United States understand increasingly the human cost in terms of slashing of all social services, destruction of our standards of living, the cannibalizing of the infrastructure of our society to sustain this combined vision of the hawks of both parties and the Committee on the Present Danger. The fight back is only just beginning.
Ralph, the Committee on the Present Danger, as you mentioned, included industrialists, included people who were key in the administration of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and later in the presidency of Harry Truman. And yet they felt the necessity to convince not only Congress but the people of the United States. And in fact, they started using the mass media, the new mass media, not only from radio but the beginning stages of television. And in particular, they went to the public and used the pressure of the public as a way to pressure Congress. In 1951, the Committee on the Present Danger launched a three-month weekly media campaign over the NBC network every Sunday night. James Conant went on and did a talk to the nation about the present danger and the need to take action. It was imperative, and it was over and over and over again. The public could not escape the media campaign. They also had written material as well as through the mass media. As Secretary of State Dean Acheson later admitted in his memoirs, quote, the purpose of NSC 68 was to so bludgeon the mass mind of top government that not only could the president make a decision, but that the decision had to be carried out. The decision was the complete militarization of the United States at the expense of social services. And as the Washington Times Herald noted, that there was a close ties between the members of this first Committee on the Present Danger and the military-industrial complex. It stated, all 33 members, quote, profited handsomely from the Marshall Plan aid program and would also profit from spending under the defense program. Ralph?
Jerry Sanders, in his book, from which we take the title of our show, Peddlers of Crisis, writes, the committee's founding statement puts forward the notion, quote, our committee is wholly independent, with no political axe to grind. On the contrary, Sanders writes, the axe that the CPD had to grind is double-edged and swings from either the Democratic or Republican side. As he points out, the Committee on the Present Danger, in its original formation and its executive committee, embraced as co-chairman not only the central figures of corporate America, but Lane Kirkland, secretary-treasurer of the AFL-CIO. It would later include George Meany, so that the labor bureaucracy is integrated in the plans of the Committee on the Present Danger and the militarization of American foreign policy, in the setting up of AFILD, which was essentially an instrument of the CIA in the areas of the world where labor was fighting back against American imperialism in Central America or in Africa. The corporate state includes Jay Lovestone, the consultant of the AFL-CIO and ILGWU, and Bayard Rustin, who was a president of the A. Philip Randolph Institute. Here we see it's not just a question of so-called hawks, but the integration of the captains of capital with their lieutenants in the labor bureaucracy.
Ralph,
and the liberal intelligentsia itself.
Ralph, you're moving ahead. That was the second incarnation of the Committee on the Present Danger. Meanwhile, the first incarnation stemmed from the academia. As you said to me earlier today in reaction to Joe McCarthy, to the media with Edward R. Murrow and Samuel Goldwyn from Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, and as I mentioned earlier, Robert E. Sherwood. And interestingly enough, Arthur Goldberg, who later became the Supreme Court Justice. When the Committee on the Present Danger was first launched December 12, 1950, its manifesto spoke of the aggressive designs of the Soviet Union, very similar to what we have today with the launching of the Committee on Present Danger about the War on Terror. And President Truman went before a nationwide radio audience in much the way that President Bush went before the nation and the world with his address at West Point, giving forth his strategy of preemptive strike. And what Truman, December 15, 1950, quote, our homes, our nation, all the things we believe in are in great danger. This danger has been created by the rulers of the Soviet Union. And he actually took the language of the Committee on Present Danger in much the way that President Bush takes the language of the Project for the New American Century, and John Kerry lifts the language of the Democratic Leadership Council. And Truman stated that, quote, meeting the present danger, end quote, that U.S. forces would have to be increased to 3.5 million people. New York Times Vice President and General Manager Julius Oakes Adler was a key figure also in the Committee on Present Danger. And so we had the integration not only of Edward R. Murrow, but of the New York Times. So let's go then to the second incarnation of the Committee on Present Danger, which Ralph was mentioning before, was led by Eugene Rostow and included many of the key figures of the House of Labor. And it was initiated after a 1957 report called the Gaither Report, which recommended a nuclear and conventional buildup to President Eisenhower. And the panel included many of the Committee on Present Danger first members. The first Committee on Present Danger existed from 1950 to 1953. And key in this was Paul Nitze. Paul Nitze, who I said was one of the primary authors of NSC 68. The Kennedy administration, moving on, was also heavily loaded with the militarists, including the architects of the NSC 68, such as Paul Nitze. And later it included Dean Rusk and Walt Rusta, who put the NSC posture into practice, and hawks such as Robert McNamara and General Maxwell Taylor. But by 1974, key figures in the formation of CPD decided that the nation had reached a virtually catatonic stage, very similar to the language that we hear from the PNAC and most particularly people like James Woolsey, who went around at universities and for and any platform he could find to talk about the advent of World War IV and how we had reached a catatonic phase in this country and had to beware of the present danger. And then Eugene Rostow, who was the Undersecretary of State under Johnson, headed up the new formation of the Coalition for a Democratic Majority, the CDM, their policy task force. And they released the paper called The Quest for Détente, in which they said, as they did the Truman years, the liberals and the Democrats must again take the lead in rallying Americans to increase our defense capabilities, both nuclear and conventional. What we have involved formation of the Committee on the Present Danger are people whose names you'll recognize today, such as Gene Kirkpatrick, Max Kampelman, Midge Dekter, and Norman Pard Horace. In fact, 13 of the 18 members of the CDM, the Coalition for a Democratic Majority, which supported the candidacy of the Superhawks, Scoop Jackson, they became the entourage of the later Committee on the Present Danger, and they were also key Democrats who later joined President Reagan in his first presidential campaign and later in his administration. Ralph, perhaps this is a good time to focus on Max Kampelman and James Schlesinger, another key figure in the Committee on the Present Danger, who later became the Secretary of Defense, and their roles between the Democrat and Republican administration.
Well, Maya, before I do that, I want to mention that in the second incarnation of the Committee on the what is called the revitalization of the CPT, it grew out of an independent group, so-called, called Team B, authorized by President Gerald R. Ford, organized by then Central Intelligence Agency Director George Herbert Walker Bush. And the purpose of Team B was to develop a massive plan for challenging the Soviet Union militarily. Headed by Richard Pipes, as you mentioned, it included Paul Nitze, Roy Kohler, William R. Van Cleve, General Daniel O'Graham, Thomas Wolfe of the RAND Corporation, General John Vogt, Major General George Keegan, Brigadier General Jasper Welch, and Paul Wolfowitz, and Seymour Weiss of the State Department, and in particular the offices for the Coalition Democratic Majority. And that's important because it comprises what is called who's who of the Democratic Party establishment. 193 key figures in the Democratic Party, as well as a cross-section of the Republican leadership. 13 of the 18 members of the Foreign Policy Task Force of the Committee for the Democratic Majority were led by Eugene Rostow and joined the CPT. And as you say, notable were Gene Kirkpatrick, Leo Kaiserling, Max Kampelman, Richard Shifter, and John B. Roche, who bridged the Republican and Democratic parties. 20 years ago, Maya, I wrote an article called Mondale Ferraro and Their Fine Feathered Friends. And I cited at the time a piece in The Nation which called The Right Turn, the 1984 Election and the Future of American Politics. And they were asking plaintively in this article, why has the liberal Walter Mondale turned right? Why do Democrats, and I'm quoting, de-emphasize the issue of jobs, inequality, threat of nuclear war, and choose the suicidal strategy of campaigning on lower deficit, increased taxes, and even higher military spending? Why is it the obvious strategy that Walter Mondale should pursue, he does not pursue? These liberals ask plaintively. And that is what we need to examine, because if we understand clearly what we've been describing with the Committee on the Present Danger, embracing both parties, we see what in fact is at stake. Indeed, all of those who were advising the Mondale candidacy at the time were, quote, investment bankers, insurance company executives, the business elites who seek to cut the deficit and increase military spending. The powerful, notable weapons producers for whom the deficit appears as an entry in the sales column were central in his campaign. The chief counselor on foreign policy to Walter Mondale, the liberal from Minnesota, was James Schlesinger and Max Kampelman of the Committee on Present Danger. They accompanied Walter Mondale all his briefings by the director of the National Security Council. Let's take a look at this because it allows us to understand the nature of this class rule. James Schlesinger was the consultant to Shearson Lehman American Express. His views on the deficit identical to those of Ronald Reagan, whose campaign, Reagan's campaign, was directed by Schlesinger in 1976. Now he's the key figure for Mondale. From the viewpoint of the ruling class, the James Schlesinger story is composed of the right stuff. He was director of strategic studies at the Rand Corporation. He was the senior staff member advising John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson from 1963 through 1969. He directed the Bureau of the Budget for Richard Nixon in 1969. He was Richard Nixon's co-director of the Office of Management and Budget in 1971. Schlesinger served Richard Nixon as chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission from 1973. When Nixon resigned, Schlesinger carried on. He became Gerald Ford's director of the Central Intelligence Agency and his Secretary of Defense. However, James Schlesinger is a flexible man. He helped run Ronald Reagan's challenge to General Ford's nomination in 1976, and when Ford lost to Jimmy Carter, James Schlesinger became the personal assistant to Jimmy Carter, and Carter appointed him Secretary of the Department of Energy. And then, while Secretary of Defense under Richard Nixon, Schlesinger, quote, was more hawkish than his boss, unquote. His advocacy of first strike capability, the central theme of the Committee on Present Danger, continued for Democrats and Republicans right through 1980 when he became the senior staff person at the Center for Strategic and International Studies at Georgetown University. And here, Schlesinger divided his services between devising stratagems of strategic nuclear superiority for the Pentagon, and his financial control of Shearson Lehman American Express. Now, the Max Kampelman saga is even more stirring. Max Kampelman is a key figure in this current reincarnation, the latest declaration of the Committee on Present Danger. Let's look at Max Kampelman's long life history in relation to American policy and the military-industrial state and the ruling class of American capital. Kampelman's relationship to Walter Mondale long antedates that of James Schlesinger. Max Kampelman counseled young Mondale when Mondale was a protege of Hubert Humphrey, when Kampelman served on the council for Hubert Humphrey from 1949 to 1959. Brothers and sisters, from 1949 to 2004, Max Kampelman, a key figure in the three incarnations of the Committee on the Present Danger. Kampelman was Lyndon Johnson's chief to the U.S. mission in the United Nations during the height of the air bombardment of Vietnam. He was a director of the right-wing Atlantic Council from 65 to 70, and he was the founder of the Committee on the Present Danger in all its incarnations. This committee grew into the Coalition for the Democratic Majority, which you have discussed. Max Kampelman was its vice chairman. They advocated the far-right policies that are now part of the standard and central program of the Democratic Party. Kampelman reestablished the Committee on the Present Danger to address the communist menace, even as he now lends himself to the neocon invocation of the category of terror. His co-members provided a who's who of the neoconservatives who campaigned for Ronald Reagan and were amongst his principal advisors, Midge Dekta, Norman Podhoretz, Leon Kaiserling, Gene Kirkpatrick, Richard Pipes, all of them Democrats who had been around Scoop Jackson, now the key figures of Reagan. Richard Pipes, Reagan's chief advisor in the Soviet Union, Gene Kirkpatrick, stepped Kampelman's shoes at the United Nations. It is Kampelman and Gene Kirkpatrick who co-authored The Strategy of Deception in 1963 on the world communist conspiracy present in every state, quote, terrorizing the American people, and the need to smash it, I wrote in 1984. Noting that Schlesinger and Campbellman were brought by Mondale to guide him in his briefing by the National Security Council director, Alex Coburn wrote in The Nation on September 29, 1984, Reagan claims that Nicaragua is exporting revolution to the rest of Central America. So does Mondale. Reagan states Nicaragua must be punished until it mends its ways and the regime overthrown, and so does Mondale. Reagan states he will invade Nicaragua. So does Mondale. Reagan justifies the invasion of Grenada. So does Mondale. Reagan says he supports the policies of Duarte. So does Mondale. Reagan blames the missile crisis on the Russians. So does Mondale. He continues, of course, we have to understand that these are policies that proceed from the Committee on the Present Danger and the hawks that are the central elements of the Democratic and Republican parties. And so, brothers and sisters, the circle, it becomes complete, because we have the policies of George W. Bush and John Kerry, preemptive war, expansion of the U.S. presence militarily in the Middle East, the inevitable introduction of the universal military training that James B. Conant has sought to establish from 1946 on in the United States. It comes full circle. It is one ruling class, and as the crisis of this system deepens, so does its aggressiveness with respect to imposing the martial law state in the United States, invoking the category of terror no less than it did the presumptive threat of a Soviet subversion to prepare the American people for permanent war.
Ralph, I think what is key is that the people who are at the core of an organization such as the Committee on the Present Danger move from administration, so that when Reagan became president, and in fact Ronald Reagan was a member of the Committee on the Present Danger in its second incarnation, 32 of CPD's members were given key posts in the Reagan administration, and Reagan was fulfilling his campaign pledge to, quote, rearm America. As you mentioned, Jean Kirkpatrick became the UN ambassador, and Richard Allen became the National Security Coordinator. William Casey, another CPD member, was the CIA director, and Paul Nitze, the author of this threat policy, was the director of policy studies, and with Eugene Rostow, and the co-founder of the committee, he was appointed the chief negotiator for theater nuclear forces in Europe, despite his long-standing opposition to any arms control dating all the way back to the Roosevelt eras. Now, on CBS Evening News, November 6, 1980, within days of Ronald Reagan's election, Eugene Rostow, Paul Nitze, and William Van Cleve, the key figures of the Committee on Present Danger, went on the news to warn that the United States must begin a massive military buildup. Once again, as it happened during the Truman administration, you saw during Ronald Reagan's administration a massive up with 11% increases in the arms budget year after year. By the time of President Carter in 1979, Carter, while the CPD folks were outside his administration, they still had massive pressure on the Carter administration, and he reversed his campaign promises to cut the defense spending, and in fact, you had a massive buildup of the arms industry, and what he said, it had to counteract a 20-year buildup by the Soviet Union. All of this was fakery. This did not exist. This was all the question of lies. Lies promoted by the military-industrial complex and promoted by the Committee on the Present Danger. We will continue with this next week when we look at the impact of the Committee on Present Danger, the War on Terror, the plans for extending the War on Terror throughout the world. Ralph?
We will also integrate it with the information regarding something called MEGA. A who's who of MEGA leads us to not only the neocons and the architects of the fake category of terror, but it leads us to the Mossad and indeed the contrivance of a policy for fragmenting each Middle Eastern country. It is linked to the Meyer Lansky fortune and to the mob's role in the Mossad and in the Israeli state. It is a gangster state, and we will describe it in full. Stay with us. Be with us next week. It is one ruling class, and we are its victims. It is our task to resist, and that's what we're in the process of doing, brothers and sisters. Join us next week.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Peddlers of Crisis and the Committee on the Present Danger, the Big Lie from the Cold War to the War on Terror. Our program will be archived at www.takingaim.info. You can contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net, that's PACBELL.net, or takingaim@wbai.org. Cassettes and CDs of this program are also available. We look forward to hearing from you. We'll be with you next week.
I'm